Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I am very happy to be back in the studio after a six-week break. And as I said in the teasers from the last couple of weeks, I haven't been vacationing. I've been on a special project. Now, actually, last summer, I was on a special project, too. I covered it a little better on the radio. But last summer, I did help compile one of the Philadelphia Church of God's newest booklets. Its title is Child Rearing with Vision. And so any of you parents out there who desire to truly understand the God-inspired goal for successful child rearing can receive this booklet upon request at thetrumpet.com website. Now, I really highly recommend it to you. It's just really a great book, and it's going to give you the vision you need to stick with child rearing. Now, this summer, I also had the opportunity to pull together the last volume of the Philadelphia Church of God's Successful Bible Story series. This series tells the story of the Bible from Genesis, really, to the book of Revelation. Now, this last volume covers the book of Acts and really a summary of the church's history to the death of the Apostle John. Of course, we know that God revealed the book of Revelation, but John was required to write it down, and Jesus Christ told him what to write. So this project that I was doing this summer really did make a deep impact on me. I thought I knew a good amount about the book of Acts, but when I was put into the situation where I had to write this story for young people, I realized how much I didn't know about the early history of God's church and the hard but exciting work of God's apostles, including Paul. Now, in the effort to make this story come alive for children, it actually came alive for me. And again, I just can't say this enough, what a thrilling project this was for me. My eyes were really more fully open to what Jesus Christ expects of true Christians today. You know, there is still a big work that has to be done, and there's only one church that can be doing it, and that church is the one that Jesus Christ is personally leading. Now, all human beings need to know where that church is, and this volume will be available in late October. So if you're interested in it, you will also be able to order this from the Trumpet website. Now, also this summer, I have to admit, I also had time to visit certain activities at our Philadelphia Youth Camp. Four of my oldest grandchildren attended the camp. I was so thrilled to not only see two of my grandchildren who live in England, and it was great to see them, but it was really just as wonderful to see all the productive, happy teens from all over the world. They were here for 3 weeks, and they were given Bible lectures. They were giving leadership lectures for the men, womanhood lectures for the young girls. They had a chance to have etiquette dinners. They had a chance to play really some of the best sports they could, and they even had dances. And there was even cultural events for them to attend. And so it was really exciting to see all that. Now, when you hear this program, and we do tape them live, but they're taped in advance. But that was a joke, by the way. Anyway, Herbert W. Armstrong College will be starting its fall session. I'll be back teaching English literature and Shakespeare this year. But since I only have one class, I'll be back writing for thetrumpet.com and also the Royal Vision magazines. And of course, I will be with all of you on Just the Best Literature. Now, I will be discussing our new series coming up very soon, so I'm going to reserve that for the next couple programs. So, I am really looking forward to these exciting months ahead for all of us. Well, on today's program, let's get back to our book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. Now, James is not in here with me today, James Brandon, and we'll have him back in here in a couple weeks, but he's getting ready for Imperial Academy to start. It's also going to be starting next week, that from the day that we're taping today, let's say. But what I want to do then is I want to finish our discussion of the chapter Cairo, 1914 to 1916. Now, I doubt if I'll be able to do that all in this program, so we might have to slip to another program. But if you remember all the way back to the last time you heard a program on Hero, remember that James and I spent a considerable amount of time discussing the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Now, I really don't think that there is a better chapter in this book to help you understand the Middle East of today. And it's something that I think everybody really needs to understand. Now, if you remember, this is what Korda said about this Sykes-Picot Agreement. And again, I'll just read this in summary. We're not going to go back into a whole big discussion of it. So if you don't know what I'm talking about in terms of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, you can go back and just listen to some of those older programs. And, you can pick it back up. But here is what Korda says about this Sykes-Picot Agreement. It says, "Few diplomatic documents in history have attracted such odium over so many decades. It now stands for most of the things Arabs resent about the Middle East as the region has evolved since 1918. The unnatural division of the Arab-speaking area of the Ottoman Empire into relatively small states, with frontiers drawn carelessly or sometimes cunningly by Western powers, the unequal distribution of natural wealth, including water and later oil, the opening up of Palestine to Jewish settlement under the protection of the British flag, the imposition of royalty a la Anglaise, sorry for my French there, on people who wanted democracy, and much else besides." So let me explain what a l'anglaise, again, excuse my French again, what it really means. And Korda does tell us at the bottom of the page. And so when the British were heavily involved in, let's say, carving up the Middle East, they really wanted it all to look like, another part of the empire. And here's what Korda says at the bottom of page 277. He says, "The British had a touching faith in the value of royalty. Hence, their support of the princely states in India until 1947, and their eagerness to place Emir Faisal on the throne of Iraq and his brother Abdullah on the throne of Jordan. Both of these monarchies were invented overnight on the British model." And so that was typical of the British. But if you look at Saudi Arabia today, and Ibn Saud, remember that's how we get Saudi Arabia from the last part of his name, Ibn Saud at least turned himself into a king without British help. And so you can see that Britain was just trying to annex that part of the Middle East, really to be like another part of the empire. And that did cause its frictions and its problems, which we will we'll discuss more today. Now, I guess one last thing I do want to say about the Sykes-Picot Agreement is we have to remember that was absolutely kept secret. And Korda does tell us, let's say, in the middle of page 280, that it actually was shocking to the world when it was revealed. And it is interesting, the people who revealed it were the Russians, and it's kind of a whole scenario that has really led to so much of the turmoil in the Middle East. But we have to remember, I think, all of you out there listening, and certainly this is very definitely what we believe here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, and we believe it here on the radio, that God is really in charge of history, and He allows things to happen for his own purpose. And we know in the end, let's say, everything is going to work out in the Middle East the way it should. And there is coming a time when all this frustration and all this horror and all these terrible things that are happening in this world, they are going to come to an end with the return of Jesus Christ. And again, that's coming very soon. But here is what Korda does tell us about the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It says, a dawning concern that the Sykes-Picot Agreement might not meet with approval outside France, Britain, and Russia led to the decision not to show it to Sir Henry McMahon for his comments before it was approved on January 5, 1916, or even afterward. It was placed in the Pandora's box of the Allies' secret agreements and would not emerge until after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, when Lenin and Trotsky decided to publish it in Izvesta and Pravda, all the secret treaties to which the Tsarist government had been a party. Lawrence would claim in 1918 in Damascus that he knew nothing about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, but that is certainly untrue. He did know about it. So here we have the Russians, or I should say those that were involved in the Bolshevik Revolution, that really did reveal the Sykes-Picot Agreement to the world. And then also I think we need to talk a little bit about the Balfour Declaration in 1917. Sykes was also involved in that, and we're going to go ahead and reserve that for a future program. But I do think the Sykes-Picot Agreement and the Balfour Declaration really did really kind of set us up for the problems we have today in the Middle East. All right, let's just talk briefly now about Lawrence's view of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And if you don't really understand the Sykes-Picot Agreement, please go back and listen to those earlier programs. I think James helped me do a really good thing there and helped me really get that clear for you what the problems were with that agreement. So I think one thing that we should not be surprised that Lawrence did not take the Sykes-Picot Agreement seriously. And in fact, he didn't take Mark Sykes seriously either. And of course, we shouldn't be surprised by that because he took very little, or maybe I should say it this way, he took very few people seriously. Now, he was really, we have to admit, he really was kind of a genius. And I think by this time he's about 26. And by the time we get to 16 and 1917, I think he gets into be about 27, 28. So Lawrence actually thought Mark Sykes was really a lightweight on the Middle East and the Arabs' future. And he had really good reason for that. And I don't know if you've been listening closely, but remember, Mark Sykes was very well known in England. He was very much liked. He had traveled a lot in the Middle East, but remember, it was more like he was collecting information for tourist films. It'd be like Mark Sykes' Middle East, almost like Steve's Europe, if you've ever seen Steve's Europe programs. But anyway, if we just remember what Lawrence had been doing, is Lawrence traveled all through the Middle East from a very young age, really. And he was up close and personable with, with the Arabic people. Lawrence knew what was truly happening politically in the Middle East. He knew what the Arabs desired for their future. And really, Sykes did not. And, that's really, I think part of the whole problem there is, Sykes had his ideas, and again, as Korda tells us on the bottom of page 277, he was really into the royalty. He really favored royalty. He really favored a royal government. And, in some ways, he and Picot both had the same thoughts that, the Middle East should be governed by, France and Britain, and they would be in charge, but there would be a figurehead, like an Arabic figurehead on the ground in the Middle East. But still, France and Britain would be calling all the shots. But Lawrence really never did buy into any of that. Now, he accepted it, but he didn't really buy into it. And here's what Corder says on page 281. And he's giving us Lawrence's view of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and maybe even more specifically, even as Sykes. It says, Lawrence's own view of the matter varied according to his mood. Now, we have to understand that sometimes people who are geniuses, you know, they can, let's say, switch moods pretty quickly, and I think Lawrence was probably really pretty good at that. So if he was in a good mood, he probably went along with the Sykes-Picot Agreement. If he was in a bad mood, he didn't. He said, Corder goes on to say that the Middle East and the Arabs' future, again, he regarded Sykes as a lightweight. He didn't know it. I mean, he had traveled a lot, but he didn't know it. Now, Corder goes on to say, when Lawrence was exhausted by the physical and psychological stress of warfare in the desert or by the endless difficulties of keeping the Bedouin together, he tortured himself on the subject, as in his note to Clayton from Wadi Siran. I've decided to go off alone to Damascus, hoping to get killed on the way. We're calling on them to fight for us on a lie, and I can't stand it. So again, when the Russians had revealed the Picot Agreement, Lawrence said he didn't know anything about it. But that's really not true. And so he did know about it. Now here's what Corder also says. He said, of course, Lawrence had a gift for self-dramatization. And again, he was like an actor in many ways. And even when it was time to film him for films, you know, it's like he set up the whole stage. So that's not untrue. But what he's saying is Lawrence was a good actor, but actually what he was saying here, that he was frustrated about, you know, kind of doing what he was doing with a lie that the Arabs were going to get their own state, that really did bother him. And here's what Corder has to say. It says, no child of Sarah's, remember this, the Sarah he's talking about is his mom. He says, no child of Sarah's could be free from a deep sense of guilt and personal responsibility or forgive himself for obeying an order to lie about what he knew to be true. And so here he did feel guilty about, you know, what was, you know, the outcome that was going to happen with the British and with the Arabs. Now, Corder goes on to say, no matter how much he wanted to break free from her religious roots, Lawrence could not. They were implanted too deeply in him to eradicate them. So we just have to remember that, you know, Lawrence did have a sense of morality, and he did have a sense of loyalty. And, you know, if he was not able to keep it, you know, it really did bother him. And I think it did, you know, it did eat him up quite a bit later on in his life. Now, Corder goes on to say, but when he wasn't moody, in other words, in his lighter moments, when things were going well, he would console himself, like many of his colleagues, with the thought that something was better than nothing. The Arabs could get one or more states and would be better off in any case if they were under Turkish domination and misrule. And so you see, it depends on where he was and what he was thinking. But again, he still knew what the Arabs really thought. And he in some ways, what's very interesting is he really did, in his own mind, have his own, like, plan for what should happen to the Arabs. And actually, he began to act on it. And I think this is what is really, really fascinating. Now, I want to read the bottom of page 281. And this is the very bottom page. And it's going to remind you, or it should remind you, of something we've discussed before. It says, Lawrence knew about McMahon's and Hussein's correspondence and noted a significant loophole in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It could be argued that if the Arabs themselves seized Damascus, Aleppo, Hama, and Hamas before the Allied forces, they might keep these cities under some form of Arab suzerainty despite the French claim on Syria. And so this is something where I think, it's going to take maybe a little bit of review on your part to understand it. And the correspondence between McMahon and Hussein is, you can find that on pages 265 to 270. And this is where the British were trying to get the Arabs to fight the Turks. And, they were offered them gold to do that, gold coins to do it. And but the Arabs were also after the British to give them their own state. And when we get into the Balfour Declaration, they certainly did not plan to have a Jewish settlement in their state. And so again, that's where, that has happened. And again, I think it's part of, obviously, it's part of, let's say, God's prophetic plan to have the Jews back in Judah. And again, that would take a long explanation to explain that. But you can find more information about that in our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong. And again, you can get that book also at the trumpet.com website. So, but again, you might have to go back to pages 265 and 270 and read those again to see what those, that correspondence was all about. And it is really kind of fascinating reading. But here was Lawrence's strategy. And again, Korda does a good job of telling us about this on page 282. And the thing that we have to understand is Lawrence was really, really pretty gutsy for a 26, 27, or 28-year-old. Really, he was an archaeology student, had not been trained in the military, but he did have this military sense about him. But here's what Korda says. It says, it became the idée fixe behind Lawrence's strategy, a secret that he withheld from all the British civil and military authorities who would instantly have discouraged him. He personally would get Faisal and the Arabs to Damascus before the British or the French and declare an independent Arab Syria before he could be stopped. Once that was done, he thought, the French would have to back down in the face of public opinion in Britain and the United States. There was the straw he clutched at through 1917 and 1918. So that was Lawrence's strategy, or maybe we could say that was Lawrence's agreement, instead of the Sykes-Picot agreement. But again, I think it does, show really part of his brilliance and part of his forward thinking. And again, he had been on the ground. He really knew, what the Arabs had wanted. And essentially, a lot of the Arabic peoples wanted democracy. They did not want monarchies. And even that has caused trouble among themselves. And, of course, Ibn Saud at the time did not realize that he would be assigned some of the greatest wealth in the world, as where Saudi Arabia is today. And, so I'm sure there's not only hard feelings about what the British and the French did, but there's hard feelings among themselves. And so, we can see those things play out today with Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And so those are problems that actually Christ is going to have to solve when he returns. All right. So the other thing I think that's important about this chapter at this point, remember, earlier in the chapter, we found out that his brother Frank had been killed in the war, and now here we are in October 1915. At this point, he finds out that his brother Will is dead, and this was absolutely devastating to him. And Lawrence, was just beside himself because they were his younger brothers. That's all the time we have for today's program. Next time, we'll work to end our chapter, Cairo 1914 to 1916. Remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can also find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. Now, please write me any comments you may have to JBL at PCOG.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1, and you can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. And so until next time, keep reading.
Been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.